Attention, American citizens and managers of the corporate news media monopoly. It is hereby proclaimed that the continued operation of the privileged media monopoly is no longer wanted. The publishing and broadcasting of propaganda constitutes a conflict of interest and, in some cases, treason. American citizens and the independent media are taking measures to bring about the dismantling of this monopoly and the restoration of a free press in America.
After years of controversy, scientists still disagree about the alleged hazards of cigarette smoking.
Absolute chaos and carnage here. It must be some sort of napalm.
The BBC airs exactly the same footage but digitally alters the word napalm for, quote, chemical weapons, hoping no one will notice.
Absolute chaos and carnage here. It must be some sort of chemical weapon.
The free press is a critical component of a free society. The news media, or the Fourth Estate, is as vital to the American Republic as the three branches of government. The press must act as a watchdog and alert the public to matters of which they wish to be informed. The press must safeguard against the abuse of power, threats that might cause harm to the public, financial wrongdoing, and political corruption. It must function as a chronological record of events, forming our collective history for future reference. Security and prosperity are not easily achieved by the individual in an advanced society. The press must provide this service to the public at large. It's not all that different from a friend that collects your mail and checks on your home while you're away on vacation. Although it can't serve individual needs as well as a community or neighborhood can, it must act in the general interest of the greater public. Although the media's delivery methods include newspapers, television stations, cable networks, magazines, blogs, and websites, not all of what is published or broadcast by the media is news. It's the publishers and broadcasters of news that constitute the press. The press or news media must be objective, neutral, and impartial. Equally important, it must maintain skepticism and a critical attitude of government and business. As such, the press must remain independent from government or corporate interests. A free press is simply not possible if it is part of or controlled by government. Likewise, it can't exist if its corporate financial, political, or ideological interests outweigh its interest in serving the public. The present conglomeration of news media corporations in America no longer serves the public's interests. The news media is highly consolidated, so much so that it constitutes a media monopoly. There is an absence of news reporting of matters that are significant or essential to the American people. What is reported is largely propaganda that serves the interests of the monopoly and in many cases results in direct harm to the public. The news media now enjoys an undeserved, privileged status. Unfortunately for American citizens, many of the familiar news media outlets are either acting fully under the government's control or in a public-private partnership. They are therefore not a part of the free press. The present state of the American media is already known by many to be problematic. For instance, most Americans know that the entire spectrum of media publications, channels, and outlets is owned by only a few companies. To get a quick snapshot of the media at the present time, let's look to the IFM, Institute of Media and Communications Policy, a non-profit research center based in Germany. They maintain a list of the top 100 international media corporations by earnings. Their list includes some cable providers that don't themselves produce much content. As you can see, the top 10 are all names you're probably familiar with: Comcast, Google, The Walt Disney Company, News Corp, DirecTV, Viacom, Time Warner, Sony Entertainment, Bertelsmann, Apple. But only 6 of these corporations produce 90% of the media in America: Comcast, News Corp, Disney, Viacom, Time Warner, and CBS. And they earn between $300 and $400 billion each year. So, when only 200 media executives control the news and entertainment media in America, there's less diversity of news, greater redundancy, greater risk of propaganda, and overall corruption. But the rest of the answer to the question, how did this happen, partly involves our view of the media being a paradigm. Not everything is what it appears to be. This problem goes way back, but let's go only back to the 1940s. After World War II, a State Department official named Frank Wisner was charged with creating a program of employing members of the media and placing operatives within the media for the purpose of controlling news in America. The publisher of the Washington Post and former Army intel officer Philip Graham was selected to direct the program, which was called Operation Mockingbird. Some of America's most respected news outfits were born from more ambitious government programs. A military colonel became the founder of CBS. He then hires employees of the CIA to work at CBS undercover. A former executive at Time Magazine becomes director of the Operations Coordination Board. CIA employee Walter Annenberg, who had just been indicted with his father in the biggest tax evasion case in history, founded TV Guide. By the early 50s, Mockingbird employed nearly 600 men and women at the New York Times, Newsweek, CBS, and other outlets. When Alan Dulles took over the program, they added 25 newspapers and wire agencies: William Paley of CBS, C.D. Jackson of Fortune Magazine, Henry Luce of Time Magazine, and Arthur Hayes Sulzberger of the New York Times. As said by former CIA Director William Colby and cited by Dave McGowan in his book Derailing Democracy, the Central Intelligence Agency owns everyone of any significance in the major media. And that's just the CIA. There are two critical points to make about the FCC. First, the FCC is both a department of government with over 1,700 employees and an independent agency governed by just 5 appointed commissioners. So when the FCC acts, it does so independent of Congress. Second, the FCC is the regulatory agency overseeing the media, including the news media. All broadcasters and publishers are required to be licensed by the FCC. You may therefore conclude that the news media has at least moderate requirements that it report the news under standards of ethics and that it serve the public interests. It may surprise you then to learn how the FCC truly works. The FCC is more like a transportation authority in what it chooses to focus on. Its strategic plan from as recent as 2011 includes 6 areas of focus. They are broadband, competition, spectrum, media, public safety and homeland security, and modernization. When the plan does reference media, it states that media regulations must promote competition and diversity. In short, the FCC might help to ensure you get broadband, cable television, and mobile phone service without discrimination, at a reasonable cost, and without presenting any threat of Islamic terrorism to you. But what CNN, Fox News, and even PBS chooses to produce for you isn't their concern, unless it involves nudity, in which case they can impose massive fines. But if CBS decided to broadcast a modern version of the War of the Worlds as a news teleplay, and if that resulted in a rise in suicides and a lot of missed work, that's their prerogative. What I suspect eliminates any hope the FCC can be of help is first that they've been there watching all along. And rather than crack down on substandard or unethical news reporting, they've simply eased up on their licensing requirements. For example, most Americans consider the 24-hour cable news channel Fox News to be required to report the news. But that's not exactly true. To meet the paltry licensing standards, Fox News specifies that they only report news between the hours of 1 a.m. and 3 a.m. Fox News only reports news 2 out of every 24 hours, and they do it only in the dead of night. So set your DVRs. And the FCC is also corrupt, which can easily be ascertained by considering what I've just explained while factoring in the open internet they voted in last year, more commonly known as the net neutrality rule. It basically put the internet under FCC control in America. Watch FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler give the most important pitch of his life.
Nearly 4 million people who participated in this proceeding. You told us you were concerned about the future of the internet, and your participation has made this the most open proceeding in FCC history. Not all of you agreed with each other, and not all of you agreed with the action that we're going to take today. But you made our process, and thus our decision, stronger. We listened, and we learned.
Sounds great. The most open process in FCC history. Of course, those 4 million comments weren't all from Americans. They were largely blank template submissions spammed by lobbying groups. And even to date, nobody's been able to report how many were in support of net neutrality and how many were opposed. But as Tom says, you listened and you learned.
4 million Americans wrote this agency to make known their ideas, thoughts, and deeply held opinions about internet openness. They lit up our phone lines, clogged our email inboxes, and jammed our online comment system. That might be messy, but whatever our disagreements are on network neutrality, I hope we can agree that that's democracy in action and something we can all support.
Yes, democracy in action and something we can all support. And all three Democrats that voted in favor of the rule made similarly goofy statements. But it looked like there might be a return to sanity when the two dissenting chairmen made their statements.
We are flip-flopping for one reason and one reason only. President Obama told us to do so.
I'm asking the FCC to reclassify internet service under Title II of a law known as the Telecommunications Act.
Pai's comments went on like that for about 15 minutes, and they were scathing. But the remaining FCC administration and their partners in the media were able to resume their mental recess. That is, until at least one citizen was smart enough to understand this was their best opportunity to be heard.
It's obvious the internet's a common carrier. It brings us all equally to the net, where we can all go up without any prejudice or bias, without any kind of discrimination. We don't want to see that end. We want to see the FCC do its job and regulate the internet for the people, not to regulate it for the corporations. We don't want you driving any influence to Comcast. We want you driving influence to the people. Okay.
In the 21st century, the internet is our free speech, but in this country, we're losing our rights to free speech. The internet was created with our public dollars as part of the public commons. It should never have been reclassified. We need to put it back.
I signed up to join the United States Army 45 years ago. I pledged to defend and support the United States Constitution, including the First Amendment. You're trying to destroy First Amendment rights to free speech and free press. I am totally against that. No, that's okay. I can be arrested.
Yeah,
you can't bully me.
Okay, we now have...
And the commons are for all the people!
You could tell that there was a lot of love in that room. The chair people smiling with glazed expressions while chatting amongst themselves is one clue as to their attitudes. I can remember back on the day of the vote in February, there was so much buildup of media messaging that I was literally shocked when the vote finally took place.
As we vote for a fast, fair, an open internet. And with that, I will call for the yeas and nays. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The ayes have it. The item is carried.
Okay. Okay, we've spent plenty of time on the boring old FCC. Now it's time to move on to the really offensive material. Nobody said the truth was pretty. I said earlier that our perception of the media is a paradigm, but that's also true of the media's perceptions of itself. A paradigm is often just another way of describing when a particular perception is false. So we, as Americans, live in a country in which not only its citizens have a false view of the media, but the media largely has a false view of itself. Our fond remembrances and cherished beliefs are fables cooked up to keep you away from your share of the American dream. But the writers needed to make sure the fable would take root and even grow more deeply in the halls of academia. For over 40 years now, the American public has lived under the yoke of Deep Throat. Under the cover of investigative journalism and press freedom, America was given a ball of lies and forced to think it was a shining example of freedom and that the system works. First, Deep Throat was identified as only a secret informant. Decades later, the writers lied again by claiming Deep Throat was a former FBI associate director who was battling dementia and couldn't manage to deny the claim. In truth, if anyone could be given credit as being Deep Throat, it's Alexander Haig. He was the guy the press never reported on, despite being a former second highest-ranking Army officer and supreme Allied commander over all European forces and NATO, and just happened to be the White House chief of staff under the Nixon administration. But it isn't really Haig you need to focus on to get the big picture. To do that only requires that you know Haig was the true source of information they attributed to an anonymous source in the fictional story called Watergate and the dutiful members of America's Free Press. Remember this guy? He's Daniel Ellsberg, the hero activist that leaked the Pentagon Papers. You probably think he's a hero, or at least a good guy, but that's the legend of the American news media talking. I'm going to help you step back and remove another false layer of the news media's credibility. You're certain to know who this guy is. It's Edward Snowden, another hero activist. The difference between Snowden and Ellsberg is that Ellsberg is a lifetime actor in the production of the mythos of American history, the necessity of American brand democracy, and the legitimacy of the press. Snowden, however, will likely exit the stage to work on other projects, while Ellsberg can still be found boasting of his heroism at any number of gay pride parades. How about these two guys? I think they're way more damaging to you and the American people than the rest of the cast. It's Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, who wrote about the Watergate scandal in the Washington Post newspaper, a popular propaganda outlet published by America's secret press department. And just to complete our cast before I show you how they put it all together, there's this little guy. Do you know who he is? Why, he's the tape recorder that Nixon requested be recording his private White House communications at all times. Americans became familiar with the recorder through the recordings that became associated with the Watergate scandal, also known as the Nixon tapes. In the former Soviet Union and in the meeting rooms of any American think tank, this recorder would be known as a bug. But when the American news media tells a lie, sometimes they go big. And to pass off their fable as being real required a number of big lies. So now we have the cast of our mythical narrative, but we haven't yet specified the greater myth they were cast to establish, nor have we specified what true motive lay underneath. Above all, these characters helped establish the myth that, under the current system, there was hope, and that justice could be had. In addition, they helped create the false notion that the press in America value the truth, and no amount of government overreach can squash their hard-hitting journalism. Lastly, they promoted the myth that activists with political issues Americans were interested in were hard at work making things better. For example, the anti-war movement and the environmentalists. The motives were fairly easy to figure out, as they are about the same as authority has had throughout the ages. America's ruling factions employed the brightest minds at academic institutions and think tanks to study society and trends. They wanted to predict which way the wind was blowing, and what threats might come to exist to their power. Any legitimate movements of the people are viewed as a threat to the power structure, who only wish to do as they wish and continue living off the backs of American citizens as they have for generations. Right away, well before the end of World War II, the answers began to come in that the citizens were becoming aware of these injustices and were growing more willing to actually perform their civic duty in order to address them. I can't stress strongly enough how much of history since the mid-1950s has been fabricated to manage the populations of the world. It sounds kind of crazy before you step back and observe the undeniable facts. Then it's up to you to decide if you're willing to continue believing. As we back away from the stage, we begin to see lesser known facets of Daniel Ellsberg. It doesn't take long before his true purpose comes into focus, and we wonder, how stupid were we for not seeing it earlier? After the Bolsheviks took over the Soviet Union, effectively destroying the country and killing millions along the way, many Soviet Bolshevik Jews immigrated to the U.S. This was the case with Daniel's parents, who ended up in Chicago. Biographies tend to ignore any details about Daniel's parents, except to say that they converted from Judaism to Christianity. Since subversion and deception are the two most common tactics of Bolshevik strategy, Daniel was certain to have been born and raised as a lifetime actor who would do whatever it took to achieve the aims of the collective. Not to belabor Ellsberg's role much further, the important pieces needed to see the truth are right out in the open. He began his education by going to Harvard on a scholarship before studying at Cambridge through a Woodrow Wilson fellowship. He then joins the Marines and leaves after 3 years as a first lieutenant. Then it's back to Harvard to join the Society of Fellows before getting his first job. Just as expected with everyday patriotic Americans, his first job is as a strategic analyst for the RAND Corporation. He then completes his economics PhD and then goes to work at the Defense Department. He gets a job that takes him to South Vietnam in 1964 under General Edward Lansdale and the State Department. When he returns, he resumes his work at RAND. Ellsberg was said to have contributed to RAND's study of conduct in the Vietnam War, but that's not for you nor I to know. But I think it hints at why the whole Nixon-Watergate deep throat fable was created in the first place. There probably were studies and at least reports laying around that would, if ever seen by the public, have brought the whole thing crashing down. So they determined they had to drown out the voices of American activists who presented a threat to them on virtually every front. After all, a criminal and lethal protection racket isn't built on sound and just principles. Neither then are its malignant enforcement branches. America's now totally complicit media became the mouthpiece of the storytellers, and what a story they told. If you doubt how I've chosen to view this period of American history, or whether it could have disguised total government propaganda as expert journalism, consider this. The reporting of Woodward and Bernstein is thought by many to be the single greatest reporting effort of all time. You better hope that that's true, but I'm suggesting to you it isn't. It won't take us long to blow apart half of the greatest reporting effort of all time. Bob Woodward was given to us as the prototypical investigative journalist. The problem is that he has no formal training in journalism and does have a shady background, including Yale University and the secret society Book and Snake. Back in 1971, nobody was questioning how some lit major had suddenly become a prominent reporter for the Washington Post. Later, however, the problem began to emerge and required evasive maneuvering. It was decided that an old and defunct weekly newspaper based out of Maryland, the Montgomery Sentinel, would serve as a fake entry on Bob's resume. So, the official biography of Woodward now shows him as a reporter for this tiny weekly paper with no official subscribership and only sold occasionally through a few 7-Eleven stores. Only after working there for a full year does he get the job at the Post, which began publishing a false history with lasting impact. Woodward's key position is used to publish the totally invented story of the RAND Corporation statist who had a change of heart, the top-level assassination squad that dropped their weapons and surrendered to a couple beat cops at the Watergate, and the dutiful but power-hungry president who somehow wound up in trouble because he bugged his own office. Are you buying any of that? I did for many years, but it only took a brief, closer look to realize it was all a fairy tale. Arriving at that conclusion was made much easier and quicker thanks to the reporting of people like Wayne Madsen, Russ Baker, Cheryl Atkison, James Tracy, Scott Creighton, and Miles Mathis. The greatest barrier I had to overcome in order to realize so much of our collective history is fabrication is my perception of the media. I kept assuming that there were too many voices and too much diversity in the news media for it to all go unreported. Then I began to see evidence of people reporting the truth back when events were taking place. Unfortunately for us, those people were never allowed to achieve prominence or authority. Making matters worse, much of what was reported had been tossed down the memory hole. As I had these revelations, I viewed many institutions within government, like universities and police departments, and even those outside government, like advocacy groups, as being a part of the media. I knew, at least, that they were advising the media and were the source of the news. It still remains a mystery to me the exact mechanisms by which so many lies and false news reports can proliferate across the entire spectrum of news media outlets. I began to see how the system works by noting that sometimes the truth is reported and following the trail from there. The problem is that no reporter is willing to challenge an official source, no matter how ludicrous the storyline. They never take two inconsistent elements of a story and connect them to form an obvious alternative explanation. Nor do they employ common sense when presented with obvious evidence of a crime or cover-up. In the worst cases, reporters actually offer not the official cover-up nor the truth, but some third, less nefarious explanation. They do so sometimes as a mere obfuscation of the truth, and other times to create the impression that they're muckraking and capable of reporting the truth. But even more commonly, the problem is simply that no reporter follows the story. One story that's a perfect example of this refusal by reporters to connect elements of a story and arrive at perfectly common sense conclusions is the tragic John F. Kennedy Jr. plane crash. If you're not familiar with the basics of the story, JFK Jr., his wife, and her sister were reported to have been flying to Martha's Vineyard. JFK's Piper Saratoga was an extremely advanced and well-liked airplane. It had autopilot, a black box, and was considered the smoothest and most flyable plane in its class. JFK Jr. was also said to have been a cautious. Media were from the Coast Guard, which reported that visibility had been clear to 8 miles, and that JFK had last communicated his final descent to the control tower at 9:39 p.m. Initial reports also said he had a co-pilot. But then the media contact was switched to the Defense Department, and the story totally changed. They claimed the weather was very windy. During the many hours that a search was still not undertaken, the news made numerous reports from unnamed sources and supposed friends of the Kennedy family. Reported that Carolyn Bissett, JFK's wife, was pregnant with a boy and in her third trimester at the time of her death. Perhaps nothing is more convincing of the media's true purpose than statements made by newsmen themselves. One such example is the statements made by John Swinton, the former chief of staff at the New York Times. He was speaking to a gathering of journalists at the New York Press Club and likely didn't intend his message for the public at large. And it's just as likely that he was inebriated to some degree. But that doesn't diminish the meaning of what he spoke. What makes the statements even more significant is that Swinton was at the Times throughout the period of the Civil War, and his statements were made not long after.
There is no such thing in America as an independent press. You are all slaves. There is not one of you who dares to express an honest opinion. If I should allow honest opinions to be printed in one issue of my paper, I would be like a fellow before 24 hours. The man who would be so foolish as to write honest opinions would be out on the street hunting for another job. The business of a New York journalist is to distort the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. We are the tools and vessels of rich men behind the scenes. We are jumping jacks. They pull the string and we dance. Our time, our talents, our lives, our possibilities are all the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes.